Hi, volleyball fans, and welcome back to Volley Talk, the podcast created for volleyball lovers who want to dig deep into what is going on in NCAA and international volleyball. I'm your host, Sarah Pavin. I'm an Olympian, beach volleyball world champion, former Nebraska Cornhusker, and longtime pro, both indoor and on the beach.
And I'm Adam Schultz, former indoor player, international volleyball coach, and the show's resident stat guy.
We have got a strictly in-season volleyball episode for you this week, and seeing as how we covered NCAA men and love last week, our feature matches will include Champions League and PVF. The first round of the Women's Champions League quarterfinals took place this week. NCAA men's conference play has kicked off, and love and the PVF are continuing to roll with some mix-ups, some standing jumps, the things we like to see. You know, so we are excited in particular to talk about some international teams this week. So let's get started. To kick off our weekly roundup, we are going to start with Champions League and the away matches for the higher ranked seeds in the Women's Champions League quarterfinals happened. We saw sweeps across the board,
which was really surprising.
Very surprising. I wasn't expecting 3-0 everywhere, but Milano beat Izazibashi. Scandici took down Woods, which we learned that that is the pronunciation for what we were calling Lods. It's Woods.
The LW switch.
The L with the cross is a W. Fenerbahce beat Vakıfbank and Conegliano beat Rzeszów.
Which of those results were the most surprising to you?
I mean, considering I had Izazibashi winning the entire thing, I was absolutely floored when I saw that.
They were not very good.
We're going to talk about that a little bit in a little while. So hang tight to that thought, okay? You are right. They looked pretty bad. So basically how this works is the higher seeded teams play away for the first match. For the second match, they play at home. And if the matches end up being split or there's a tie at the end of the back and forth, there is a golden set, just one set, that I believe it's played to 15.
And right after the...
immediately after the match ends to determine the winner. So that's why the higher ranked seeds go away first. So if it does come down to a golden set, they play at home.
Those golden sets are wild.
Wild. I think I've only participated in one of them ever against Dynamo Moscow in Champions League 1 year. We won.
They're so nerve-wracking. It's... because you either win or lose a match, and then you've got to flip right away and play for your life to 15. It's one of the craziest things I've ever experienced in sport.
Yeah, we could potentially see that happening with Izazibashi. We could see that happening with Vakıfbank, because those are the two higher seeds that lost this week. But exciting stuff. Not what we expected, sweeps across the board, but it was great volleyball to watch. In NCAA men's volleyball, number 2 UCLA beat number 10 Stanford in both of their matches this week. They won 3-1 and 3-0.
And they only lost that one set because they missed 13 serves at the beginning of that match in one set alone.
In the first match, UCLA missed 30 serves. It was wild. And I think it's worth noting Andrew Rowan was out. Trent Taliaferro played. So I think the first set he was kind of like working through his nerves and stuff, but he found his rhythm. Rowan did have to come in to save the day in the second night because things were kind of falling apart. The wheels were falling off. The UCLA offense was just
I thought Taliaferro played better in the first match than he did in the second one.
Absolutely, yes. But we did get a question that I kind of want to touch on now instead of in the listener questions because it was talking about this match in particular. So our listener wrote in and asked, what do we mean specifically by the setter-middle connection? And this was referencing Andrew Rowan versus Taliaferro when they're setting Cameron Thorne. So if you're familiar with UCLA, you know what I mean. So this listener said, at one point, Rowan almost appeared to pull Cameron in a certain direction with his quick set Is that based on Andrew's glimpse of the other side of the net and trying to get Cameron to swing in a certain direction?
So this is a really interesting question, and you never know what's going through a setter's head, but I have a couple thoughts about watching Rowan set. So you might not see this on camera, but when you watch him set live, he looks at the other side of the net longer than almost any other setter I've ever seen. He does a full shoulder check, looks to see where the offense is before he delivers the ball. Him and Thorne definitely need to be on the same page in terms of what set they're running, but it wouldn't surprise me if they've worked out, like, hey, I might push you a little bit or I might leave you inside. And the thing about Thorne is that he's on the floor longer than most middles because he gets off the ground so quick that he has time to adjust and to drift. And you see him float into a couple sets, and whether that's a designed play or whether that just happens based on his athletic ability, you'd have to ask them. But their connection and the way he knows where Thorne is going to be is incredibly impressive to watch. And him getting him that ball is what we talk about when we talk about that connection.
Yeah, so the setter middle connection, it's because the play is happening so fast, it's so important to make sure that the setter is setting the ball within the hitter's available window and that the height is correct. And so that's what we mean about the connection. And a lot, like, it's easy to dial in with a lot of middles because you can usually see them while they're in the air and you can see, like, the window that their hitting arm creates. What makes Cameron Thorne so difficult to set is that he gets off the ground very fast, so the setters aren't necessarily seeing him as they're setting the ball, and he jumps so high that it's just kind of trippy because you can see most middles in the air, but because he probably hasn't even gotten off the ground yet on contact and the height is so high, that makes it tricky. So Taliaferro was avoiding setting Thorne.
Correct.
So much. And you could see Cameron getting so frustrated, like, why aren't you giving me the ball? But I think it's because he just can't see it. And as a setter, you're trained, like, don't set your middle unless you see them.
Well, you saw as soon as Rowan came in, he set him four times in a row.
Oh my gosh, he was happy again.
Yeah. Those two are just boys.
So hopefully that kind of answers your question. We don't know for sure if that's a thought process, but Cameron Thorne is athletic enough and jumps well enough that, like, no matter where Rowan sets it laterally, he can float to the ball.
And Rowan is definitely looking at the defensive setup as he's setting the ball. So it's definitely within the realm of possibility.
Continuing on, number four UC Irvine snapped their four-game losing streak, beating number eight Pepperdine 3-0. Number nine Loyola Chicago beat number 12 Ball State in four. And the matches that we thought were going to be really exciting, number five USC versus number six BYU, USC took both of those matches. They took the first in five, and the second they swept BYU. So that was very interesting. Another thing that I thought was interesting was to see Cal State Northridge jump up to number seven in this last week's poll without really having beaten anybody.
Yeah, that was a little strange to me.
Yeah, I'm like, did you just get that by default because, like, Loyola Chicago lost and then Stanford had a weird loss? And, like, but CSUN hasn't beaten anybody, in my opinion, for them to earn that ranking. So I was kind of shocked at that development. But what I was satisfied with was that McKendree, it was finally getting the respect they deserve, and they had the number 11 seed this past week. McKendree has been knocking off teams above them week after week after week. And, like, finally the committee, like, pushed them up a little bit. So that one, I was like,
that one is well deserved.
Yeah. The CSUN one, however, had me scratching my head. So we'll see how the rankings shake out this week. It's not that we necessarily saw upsets, but we saw highly ranked teams losing a couple in a row. So, yeah, we'll see if there's any movement this week.
Looking at love from this past week, the head-to-head saw Salt Lake beating Omaha 3-1. Omaha is continuing to drop in the rankings and to struggle
rapid,
a little bit.
Rapid descent.
And then in the weekend with love, Houston beat Atlanta in a reverse sweep 3-2. I've watched half that match so far, and it was really interesting. Atlanta started really well, so now I'm at the part where Houston comes back and wins the next three. So I might post about that online, but that was a really entertaining game. So if you haven't watched it, I would go back and look at that one. Atlanta then recovered and beat Austin 3-1, and Madison continues their winning streak, beating Houston 3-1. So we're starting to see some movement. Madison is coming on. Omaha is dropping. It'll be interesting to see what happens there. Atlanta's still strongly in the lead, but there's a lot of jockeying happening, so we'll see what happens. If we look at the final standings, the bottom three teams now all have 4 wins. So coming down the stretch into the playoffs, it's going to be really important for those teams to grind out some wins. So let's see what happens.
Well, and I think Omaha and Madison are playing each other this week, and they're sitting at the bottom together.
I think Madison's going to win.
Okay, I kind of felt crazy because I never really at the beginning of the season, I didn't think Omaha was going to be in the discussion. And then they were, and they were, like, doing pretty well, and I felt kind of crazy. But now they're coming back to earth now, so I'm like,
well, okay. We talked about this before. They gelled and got off to a really good start quickly. And now they're kind of leveling off, and the other teams are finding a little bit of rhythm. But I think your initial assessment was accurate.
Again, I say this every week, but the one that really I dropped the ball big time was Madison. But maybe they are going to come on and be like, just kidding, we are going to start like 0-20 and we're going to come back and just like win everything.
Well, I think they found a little bit of a winning formula now. It'll be interesting to watch them in the coming weeks. Looking at the PDF, Vegas is in the middle of one. It's not going great. They lost 3-0 to Grand Rapids, and then they followed that up with losses to Indy 3-1 and Atlanta 3-2. So Vegas, kind of like Omaha, started out really strong, and they have not been able to close out matches. So it'll be interesting to see where they go. They seem to have a lot of moving parts in their lineup, and they haven't really found anything that's worked for them recently, so I don't know how they're going to pull out of this.
We did watch their match against Indy. We're going to talk about that a little bit later, but I had so many questions.
Agreed.
Watching that match.
Agreed. Grand Rapids followed up their win, having beaten Vegas, which we talked about, with another win over San Diego 3-2. And then Omaha also fought back and now has the same record as Orlando at 10-4. So they're battling it out at the top of the league. So we will see what happens. And my dark horse pick, Indy, is right behind them. So I think they're going to keep climbing.
Well, and I think Omaha and Orlando are playing each other this week. So
they are. We'll see that question in the game later on in the episode.
Our first feature match of the week involves the Champions League quarterfinals, Woods versus Scandici. But we did also watch Milano versus Izazibashi. So we wanted to just like touch on that one a little bit, and then we'll dive a little bit deeper into the Woods Scandici match.
So I think looking at the Izazibashi roster, we thought that they were going to be very good.
And I had them as my pick to win the whole thing. I'm not saying they won't still, but wow.
There's no other way to say it other than they were terrible.
Terrible. They got smoked by Milano.
For people who aren't familiar with their team, let's just quickly go over their roster.
Highlight some of the ones that people will probably know for
sure.
Okay,
so they have Catherine Plummer.
Yes.
Right? They have Dana Retke. They have Alexa Gray, who is a Canadian left side, who is very good. And they have Boskovic.
Highest paid player in the world, everybody.
Your outside core is
amazing.
Very, very good. Very well paid. You have a top middle in Dana Retke. And they also have Jovana Stevanovic coming off the bench on that team. Like, on paper, they are absolutely stacked. And on the court, they were absolutely awful.
Catherine Plummer was terrible.
She hit 0. They pulled her after she got set 9 times. She was non-existent.
Oh my gosh, like, it was not good. She was not getting off the ground. She could not score. She just looked out of it. Boskovic was having a hell of a time scoring. They were not setting Retke. Honestly, I'm putting a lot of this on the setter. Like, the setting was very inconsistent. So I could see Boskovic getting a little frustrated. The balls were not high enough for her. They were all over. Like, I don't know. I had so many questions. Like, why are you not setting Retke?
Retke only got
Tiana the ball high enough, please.
Recchi only got six sets all match. Boscovich hit 225 on 31 sets, which isn't terrible. But if you watched her, she never looked comfortable.
No, she did not look like herself, for sure. But I did think Alexa Gray did a really good job when she came in for Plummer.
I agree. But I thought, I had the same feeling as you. The setter, just, there was no rhythm, no continuity. I didn't think they passed particularly poorly. It was just flat. And you could see the coach was
losing his mind.
He threw, I don't want to say he threw in the towel, but he just had no idea what team he was seeing on the floor. I 100% expect this to go to a golden set. They will not play like that again. I hope not
because, wow, it was shocking watching this match. I mean, to Milano's credit, they played very well. They completely dismantled them. Like, Ngannou, if we're looking at the opposite battle, it was no comparison. She dominated Boscovich in that game.
She hit 469 on 32 sets. So they got almost the same number of sets, and it was, yeah, not even comparable.
Anna Danese played really well. Milano just looked like a much more polished team, more prepared, and Izazibashi just looked confused.
Yeah, that's the match I want to watch next week. I want to see what the response is. I mean, you have to win this at this point or your Champions League is done. And you know, with a team like that, their goal is to win Champions League. And for them to go out that way will be hugely disappointing.
On to a better match, Woods versus Scandici. I honestly, going into this match and not having much familiarity with the Woods team, and I haven't really watched much of Scandici this year, I was expecting Scandici to kind of roll through this match, and Scandici did sweep, don't get me wrong, but the sets were very close. And I think the biggest difference, and I don't know if you agree with this or not, is like Woods was there, and then they would just make like one or two errors after 20, and then the set was gone. And so they would have a huge lead, momentum shift, and then the set was gone. So I was impressed with Woods. I thought they definitely should have pushed it further than three. It was a fun match to watch.
Yeah, it was really well played. I think it's interesting, Woods is almost completely Polish players, so they don't really have any foreigners. And not that that matters, because the Polish players in the league is very good, but it always helps when you can bring in a couple foreigners to kind of help your team. And so to have an all-local team, I think A, is really cool, and B, it just shows the strength of the league in general, in my opinion.
So what you see is like there are usually foreigner limits in when you're playing within your country's league. So in Turkey, for example, you can only have two foreign players on the court at the same time. But then when you go to Champions League, those rules don't count anymore. So that's why, because Turkey has so much money, that's why you see them stack their roster with really strong foreign players who they might rotate through the Turkish league, but they're there to win Champions League. The Italian league allows, like, I want to say five foreigners on the court at one time. So I'm not sure what Poland's is, but because Poland can't offer as much money as those countries,
in general,
foreign players cost more. And so it doesn't shock me. Like, their opposite is Italian, their left side is Serbian, and the rest of the roster that was playing on the court was Polish.
And I thought their right side played pretty well, actually.
And Wanwu?
Yeah.
She was up and down for me.
You very much are error averse. And so I understand why you're saying that, because she was 11 for 27 kill-wise, but she also made five errors, being blocked four times. So I think the thing we saw with her was, I'm not going to call her reckless, but there were definitely some plays where she made, I call them eyes closed swings against a well-formed block that didn't end up in her favor. And if we would have seen maybe some better decision-making, a tip or keep that ball in play, her stats would have been better, but they also needed somebody to score points. So I like the way she approached the match, and I thought going after and scoring points was important for Woods.
She was definitely their best point scorer. I agree with you there. I mean, if you're not familiar with Scandici, some of the players that you might recognize from that team is Antropova is their opposite. Carol from Brazil is one of their middles. Maya Onjenovic from Serbia is their setter. Brenda Castillo is their libero. And then Kara Bajma and Britt Herbots are their outside. So bigger names for sure. So it doesn't shock me that Scandici was such a strong blocking team. Like Carol is an excellent blocker. Antropova is 6'7", putting up massive wall there. Yeah, their opposite for Woods, the opposite was definitely the focus, the left sides for Woods, particularly Blagojevic, struggled. She unfortunately was matched up with Antropova, and
well, she hit minus 150. She got 20 sets. She only had 3 kills, and she was blocked 5 times. So that
it was just not a good matchup for her at all.
No, and we talk about the sets being close. Like, we're talking 25-22, 25-22, 25-21. And if we look at the numbers, Scandici outblocked Woods 16-8. And in the first two sets, Woods only had one block in set one, one block in set two. They ended up getting 6 in the third set. But quite frankly, watching that match, blocking was the difference. And especially at the end of sets, when you knew where the ball had to go for them to score points, that was the difference in my mind.
Well, and we like Damaske for Woods, I thought she did a pretty good job. She was pretty fearless, started out hammering sharp angle, and Scandici's block was like out of position, and you saw Scandici make that adjustment and move the block in, creating some errors for Damaske as she tried to find the line. So I liked to see the adjustment that way. Drushovska came in for Blagojevic, who she was much bigger.
Yes.
And I think that she started slow because they targeted her on serve receive immediately, and it was like 2 aces in a row. But she found her rhythm and was able to score some points and put up a bigger block against Antropova, which helped.
Yeah, you know, I thought from a coaching standpoint that there were good adjustments made throughout the match the whole way through. You talked about the blocking adjustment. I like the serving strategies in general of players coming in and out and trying to serve seams. And I mean, Woods was, they were smaller. Like, there was that definite advantage to Scandici. And so seeing how they adjusted for that, how they tried to load up and what their game plan was defensively, it was a well-coached match, I thought.
I did not love the Woods libero. Wizjak, she really struggled, in my opinion, in all facets of her position.
When your libero is targeted the most on serve receive and gives up the most aces, so they got aced 6 times in that match, 3 of them were by her, and she had 23 receptions, which was more than anybody else on the floor.
Almost double.
That's not where you want to be. And, you know, some liberos take up half the court and they pass both seams.
Well, you can just tell the ones who are confident and are like, I dare you to serve me.
Yeah, and sometimes that happens. She was not passing half the court.
They were like pinching her out almost.
Yeah. I honestly, because you saw at the end of matches, she got a little tight and then you knew the ball had to go outside and Scandici was just waiting for those sets. I'm very curious if they would have passed better, especially down the stretch, if they could have pulled out one or two of those sets. And I'm interested to see if she starts the next match. Like, if I don't know who else they have on their roster.
They have another libero on the roster, but I don't know. I didn't feel like Woods ran the middle very much. Maybe they did, and I just, like, blacked out.
No, they were outside heavy. They had 39 sets to Damaske. They had 27 to Nwanwu, and Blagojevic got 20. They only set their middles like 5, 7, and 5. So
I think they just need to, I know, I preach on this all the time. Like, even if your middles aren't going to score, like, help your outsides out a little bit and just like feed them early, you know?
Yeah. So let me ask you this. What did you think of Scandici's serving? Like, do you think that they applied enough pressure to take the middle out, or do you think that was a setting error by Woods?
I mean, as we said, the libero wasn't passing great, but like, I don't think they passed so horrendously that they couldn't run the middle.
I mean,
Scandici was definitely bringing it from the service line, don't get me wrong. But like, you see that from Woods, but then conversely, you see, I was shocked at how little Scandici ran their left side. They were very right side middle dominant. And like, Bajma can score, and Herbots is like more of a ball control left side, but I was really surprised at how little they ran their left side.
Well, so let me ask you this. you played with Carol. Carol, in my opinion, moves incredibly well laterally. She closes the outside really well as a blocker, but she's a little undersized. If I'm looking at that team, I want to run against her out of the middle to try and get her to commit because she's a little bit smaller and maybe slow her down moving out to the outside pins. And I thought that was an area where Woods could have had an advantage, and they didn't run at her in the middle at all. And she closed and blocked really well. So that's an adjustment that I would expect them to make coming into the next set.
Yeah, I mean, Carol makes big moves out of the middle. But again, with a size matchup, like, she jumps well, don't get me wrong. But, like, just keep her honest, yeah, like you were saying. Like, even if she makes a big move on your middle and gets a block, like, at least make her pay attention to them for a little longer to hopefully create a seam or something. Because Carol reaching laterally is not clearing the net by very much. Carol full max jumping is putting a roof over your head. I hope they do the same thing to make it a better match next time.
I mean, I thought this was an incredibly entertaining match. I think Scandici is going to end up winning, but I think that the next one could go 4 or 5. I think that Woods is close enough with a few adjustments. If their passing gets a little better and runs the middle, that it could be, they could steal a couple sets here. So I'm interested to see this rematch this week.
Yeah, I mean, and definitely, like, this is where you see the cream rise to the top. And in the final fours of Champions League, you do typically see Italian teams, Turkish teams, and Russian teams when Russia is involved. Like, it's not often you see other countries. So, I mean, Woods is definitely good, and it was an entertaining match. I think they can push them, but do I think they're a final four level team? No. Our second feature match of the week takes us to the PVF for the Vegas Thrill versus the Indy Ignite. There were some interesting things happening. Namely, Cameron Hanna was not playing for Vegas. And we saw Anna De Beer in her second career start after returning from her ankle injury that she got in the Final Four in December. Meaning Nina Kajic was out. And Elena Scott is still the starting libero. It's been a few matches now. So look at how happy Adam is. Wow. So yeah, a couple interesting lineup switches for both sides. More, not head scratching on the indie side, but definitely had me wondering what's going on from the Vegas perspective.
Well, I'll tell you what's happening from the Vegas perspective.
Okay.
Vegas has a consistency issue, namely with their two outsides. You have Hannah Maddox, who is either all world or can't find the court. And this last match was an example of can't find the court. I'm not sure in the whole match whether she hit a single ball in the lines on the court, because every time she swung, it looked like she was trying to get a touch. She just could not find it last night. And this is not uncommon for them, and that's the problem, right?
I've seen this from Maddox all season long.
Hannah Maddox is a very dynamic athlete. You watch her play and she's fun to watch because she gets off the ground well, she jumps well, she swings hard, but she's not settling in as the year goes in, and she's not getting better, in my opinion. In fact, she might be moving the wrong way in that regard.
And people really like her though.
Yeah, and it's for every reason that we talked about, right? It's she's fun to watch, she's dynamic, she has all of those positive attributes that could make her a great athlete, but she was set 34 times last match, and she hit 029. She got blocked 4 times, and she made 6 hitting errors. You just can't play like that. Now, when she's good, she's really good, and that's what you saw when they were winning those matches, was that she was scoring, but teams have either started to figure her out or she's having some connection issues. I can't put my finger on it, but it's not going well.
No. I have been saying this about her since probably the first match we watched her play. I'm like, she's either amazing or goes on these error streaks, and you see it in all skills, including her serving, passing. Yeah, and you saw it again. And so Cameron Hanna wasn't playing. They put Jardine in to start, who I feel like is another similar player to Maddox in what we were just saying, as far as is either unconscious all world or can't find the court. I feel like those two athletes are very similar in that. And last night was a can't find the court issue with Jardine too.
I think that's the profile of almost all of their outside hitters, opposites included. Like, look at their roster.
I feel like Cameron Hanna has been their, like, consistent athlete, though. I don't know what has happened, like, in the last... Maybe she was injured. Maybe, you know, she really was terrible last match or something. I don't know. But, like, she has been pretty consistent for me all season. And, like, say what you want about Charity Looper. She's not streaky. She might not score all the time, but she's not making straight-up errors.
Well, she started the last match... Six total sets, she hit -333. So,
like, they didn't give her a chance. Yeah. That's my point. They, like, took her out right away and then didn't put her in. And it was literally a revolving door of substitutions from that point forward. And I'm like, what are you doing?
I don't think the Vegas coach knows what to do at this point. I think he had an idea of what he wanted his lineup to be at the beginning of the season, and it's not working. And now he doesn't know which outsides to put in, and it looks like the confidence of all of the outsides is eroding. Like, when I watch that team, it seems like they don't know what their roles are. They don't know whether they're going to play. They don't know what the expectation is. It almost feels to me like all of the outside hitters are looking over their shoulder, wondering if this error is going to be the one that gets them pulled off the court. And I'm not blaming the coach, but that's just the feel on the floor when I watch the match.
It's a scary place to be as an athlete if that's what you're wondering.
But again, if I were to ask you who are the starting outsides on Vegas, I don't think you can answer that question. And it's not like they don't have good athletes. Charity Looper's not playing. Like you said, Cameron Hanna's not playing. They have, like, I don't know, we watched Willow Johnson come in and light it up. Like,
it's, for a set, and then she just, like, came down to earth and got blocked. Like, we saw... Who started? Looper and Maddox started. He gave up on Looper right away, put Mayfield in, who, I'm sorry, she didn't do much. It's not like she came in and, like, made a huge difference. And then, meanwhile, Mayfield's in, and then Hannah Maddox just takes a complete dive and is making errors left and right, keeps Maddox in forever, and then finally puts Grace Loberg in, who also came in and did nothing. Meanwhile, Looper's there on the bench, and I'm like, why are you keeping these athletes in who are not moving the team forward?
Well, I think he views Mayfield as the steadying force there. That's got to be what it is, because she hit .238 on 21 balls, like 7 kills, 1 block, 1 error. Like, I think that maybe he feels she can be that steady player, and then he's rotating in trying to find a point scorer who's on at that point. You just, from a coaching standpoint, you've got to try and figure out how to maximize the athletes you have, and maybe that's, you know, leaving them in for a set to work through it. Like, which of your athletes are going to work through their slow starts? Which are going to come out? How do you find a way to motivate them? And I'm not saying it's easy, and I don't know him as a coach, but though, that's what I'm seeing from the outside with how those athletes are playing. I did think that Stout played a pretty good game.
Their middles were solid. Yeah. Oblad and Stout were solid, but you just saw the outsides, just nobody knew what was going on.
Yeah. What did you think of the setting decision in that match? Because Childress just needs to play all the time.
Oh my gosh. I understand why they originally came in. So there was a double sub that happened in set 3, and then Carly Graham and Willow Johnson came in for that double sub, and then they stayed in. Okay, Willow Johnson went off in set 3. Understandable. Keep her in set 4, see if she can keep rolling with that. But you need to put Childress back in. I was scratching my head being like, why is he keeping this Graham girl in? Because the sets were all over the place. And Childress is, like, the calming presence. She's the leader on the court. She's an outstanding setter. Like, is she able to run down, like, balls that are spraying everywhere? No, but, like, she delivers a ball. Neither can Graham. Exactly.
But so this to me is, this was the defining moment where I was like, okay, this coach he doesn't know how to get his team going, because you have your outsides rotating in and off the court in a turnstile fashion. You have, Childress is no longer in her prime, but she has experience. She knows how to set the ball, and they weren't passing particularly poorly. So Childress was there and able to deliver the ball. And the fact that you took her off the court when she wasn't playing well means that
you're just... Not even that she wasn't playing well. It was just like, well, let's put a bigger block in the front row and you're out for good.
Well, your outside hitters have no rhythm. And instead of dealing with that situation for what it was, you switch the setter hoping to find some kind of rhythm, or banking that Willow and Graham are going to keep the magic running. Like, it's happening so quick. It doesn't seem like, all of the decisions seem reactionary.
I was just going to use that exact term. Watching it, I'm like, this is very impulsive and reactionary instead of like well thought out.
Watching the match, the coach and Childress need to find a way to bring some steadiness to that team, to bring some calmness and some tranquility there. And the outside hitters, you have good enough athletes, they will figure it out. But when everybody is kind of running around, it doesn't work well.
Okay, let's talk about Indy.
All right. So we occasionally get accused of being too negative.
Occasionally.
Which... fair enough about Vegas. But I will say I saw some really good things from Indy. So first and foremost, I thought Sydney Hilly played a really good game all the way through.
I have been critical of Sydney Hilly this season, I will admit it. And I have said that she usually starts out really well in the first set and kind of like declines as the match progresses. In the matches we have watched, she in this match stayed consistent. And I thought she ran a good offense.
I loved seeing Anna DeBeer on the floor. Like, that's just a really good feel-good story. It's cool that her and Elena are back on the court together. I think Elena's done a great job.
Adam loves Elena Scott, his favorite libero ever. Honestly, I'm happy to see her starting now, because I was kind of scratching my head earlier in the season, like, when is this switch going to happen?
Yeah, and she's playing well. She's defending well. I think that she brings a good presence to that floor.
I love her out-of-system setting.
Yeah.
We know that is a passion of mine, libero's setting.
So, and I thought Anna did a pretty good job. Like, they set her 22 times. She hit 273, you know, didn't make a ton of errors. You got from her, I think, what you expect. One thing I'm curious, and I know she's only played two matches, is she was able to find the floor in college against blockers and against defenses. I'm not sure if she's not quite as dynamic or she's not quite back to where she was, but she used a lot of hands, which is fine, you know, but I didn't see kind of as much of those terminal angle swings that we saw back in college. Hopefully she's able to find that rhythm, because I think that she's going to need to elevate just a little from an offensive standpoint if Indy is going to keep kind of pushing up the rankings.
I saw the same thing. And like, coming back from an ankle injury is tough. Like, you're not able to like be as explosive. You're a little tentative, perhaps. Her angle swings were like very deep angle right to the libero. We didn't see her trying for anything sharper. Her only swings that were really scoring were, as you said, when she used the block or was hitting down the line. I'm not sure she's hitting hard enough right now to be able to be terminal without using hands.
Yeah.
So she's either going to have to put more on it or start using her wrist to get the ball to move a little more. And that is something that, like, as you transition to higher and higher levels, you have to do. And it's something that you figure out. But as defenses get better, like, you have to start making the ball move. You can't just hit straight. Again, is it injury related? Maybe, but we'll see how she problem solves.
So the thing about Indy, I think overall, is that their outsides, including their opposite, are a little undersized.
They're understatement.
They're a little small. And so they're going to have to run the middle really well.
And pass well.
And, you know, with Anna and Elena, I think you have a good passing core there. I thought that Sydney Hilly did a good job of running the middle. We saw Lydia Martin go 7-for-12 with no hitting errors. She hit 583. Like, so she was a threat, which was really good. I think if Indy's going to push those top two teams, that Crawford's going to need to be more of a threat in the middle. We all know she's a very good blocking middle and she can stabilize the defensive unit, but because they don't have a monster on the outside, she also needs to be a threat. And that's something that her and Sydney are going to have to work out.
She just doesn't put enough pace on her slide. It just looks like she's not upright. It always looks like she's kind of falling backwards or is like, yeah, it doesn't look smooth and she's just not putting enough on it to score.
And it's not like they're not setting her. Like, she got 13 sets.
She's set way more with Indy than she ever was with Wisconsin.
Yeah, and I hope that she's able to figure it out because she made two errors and she only had three kills. So she's not that efficient. And that, to me, is going to be the key of whether they can push those top teams is, can she be productive offensively?
Well, part of me wonders, like, is Martin capable of running behind the setter? Because I would almost, if she is, I would put Crawford with the two hitters in the front row, let her just hit the basic, like, quick and 31, because Crawford is a very good blocker.
Yeah.
So I'm like, I'm wondering if Martin isn't good off of one foot and it's just Crawford's there by default. But I think if they made that switch, like, it could be more productive perhaps.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. I think for me, watching Indy, and I think they're playing well right now.
That Taylor played better than I've ever seen her. Like,
yep.
I've been critical of her hitting from the pin. Like, she was scoring well.
Yeah. But again, they don't have, Indy doesn't have like an out-of-system hitter that they can just set the ball to and have them go up and rip away against three blocks. And so with the way they're built, if Crawford can be a threat, I think you'll keep seeing Teeler have a good game. Remember, Mena have a good game. Anna De Beers will be able to find, because they can all kind of work the holes in the block if they're half a second late or if there's a little bit of movement. But the middles need to be active for that to happen. And I thought, like I said, I thought Lydia Martin did a good job, but Crawford's going to need to be a little better. I thought it was overall, it was a good game.
Tons of errors by Vegas, but Indy was stable.
Yeah, and I thought that you're seeing these teams on different trajectories, in my opinion. I think Indy is starting to figure it out. I think they're finding more stability with Elena Scott and Anna De Beer on the court. And Vegas, there is no consistency there. They don't know who's going to play. They don't know who's going to stay off the court. It looks like people are worried. We'll see if they're able to kind of solidify that. I would almost just pick a lineup for a match and go, you guys aren't coming off the floor. Like, you need to figure it out. That's, to me, maybe the next step there. But, yeah, it'll be interesting to watch these two teams because they're very close in the standings and to see what happens in the next couple of weeks. All right, it's game time here on the pod. And today we're going to play a little game called Confirm or Deny.
It's been a while since we played this one, but he's bringing it back.
So I am going to make a statement, and you are going to either confirm that statement or deny that statement, and then we can chat about it if it requires. So this week in Champions League, we saw all sweeps, 3-0. Confirm or deny, you think that the Women's Champions League second round will also all end in sweeps?
Deny. I feel like the Izazi-Bashi Milano match will go further than three. I hope Izazi-Bashi, like, wins just because I picked them to win, but I think Milano's good enough to take at least a set off of them for sure. Maybe I'll just be completely wrong and Milano will win the whole thing, but so I think that one will go past three, and I also think the Vakıf Bank Fenerbahçe match will go past three. I want the Woods Scandici game to do it, but like playing in Scandici, I'm not convinced, and I just think Conegliano is like OP.
Fair enough. I think that those are odds wise, that's probably the right choice. And I think the matches that you picked make sense to go more than three. Looking at the Love League, and specifically Atlanta, who is in first place, we saw Grubbs, who's their opposite, go down 2 weeks ago, I believe. And Grubbs has been replaced by Coutinho on the right side. And it looks like the return time for Grubbs is undetermined at this point. So they might have to play with Coutinho for the rest of the season. Do you think that Atlanta can stay at the top of the standings without Grubbs going into the playoffs?
Interesting question. I'm going to go against my instincts here and say confirm. I think we've seen certain players on Atlanta elevate. Emily Adams, for example, like she has gotten better and better.
She's been very good.
Yeah, it's been really cool to see. Kelsey Cook has like kind of stepped up, particularly on, I mean, she's always good defensively, but she has really stepped up. So I think for Coutinho, the load doesn't have to be on her. She can be more of a support player offensively. So I don't think, I mean, Grubbs has obviously had a great season and she scores a lot of points for Atlanta, but I think because other players have kind of elevated, I don't think it's going to, her loss will affect them as much as it may have like a few weeks ago.
I think in the regular season, they're far enough ahead that it won't matter. I think
was your question including playoffs? I'll keep what I said.
I was going to say, I think for the regular season, it won't matter. They're far enough ahead that, and they're skilled enough in the other positions that they'll beat most of the teams. My worry would be if they play Houston again in the finals, they're going to need production from her. Now, Coutinho has had a couple really good matches, but she's also had a bunch of mediocre matches. So she's a little less consistent than Grubbs, I would say. And so my worry would be for the finals when they make it that far versus the regular season. All right. Now, I alluded to this at the beginning of the podcast. Omaha and Orlando are at the top of the standings in PVF. They will play two more times this season. Confirm or deny that Orlando will win both of those matches?
I have to give respect where respect is due. Confirm. There is no indication to me that Orlando will lose those matches. They've handled Omaha the last few times they've played them. Like, if I was seeing something in other matches and stuff that like made me kind of take a second look, fine, but like I haven't, so I'm gonna say confirm.
I'm gonna deny this. I think they're gonna split. I think they're gonna go 1-1. I do think that Orlando will end at the top of the standings, but I think they split these last two games 1-1. Okay, and last question for confirm or deny, we're gonna move to the NCAA men's league. Long Beach is the only undefeated team left in the NCAA. They still have to play four games on the road against very good teams. So two at UC Irvine and two in Hawaii. Do they finish the season undefeated? Confirm or deny?
Deny. I think if they're playing on the road in Hawaii, that's a very hostile environment and it's very pro-Hawaii. Hawaii is also a very well-rounded team. I think that every team, it's very, very rare that you see a team go undefeated throughout a season. And I think that hiccups are kind of part of the process to winning long-term. So even if they do lose, I wouldn't be concerned, but I don't think they're going to go unscathed.
Well, those are the questions we had for confirm or deny. I like to keep it across all the leagues and everything we're watching, but I liked your answers.
I'm sure there's going to be so many disagreements with me. I want to hear them because I'm probably wrong in a lot of these. It is time for listener questions. We have got a nice lineup today. Our first question, it was submitted a few weeks ago, but I think it's still worth discussing. So for Love Atlanta, do you think that Fairbanks runs the offense better than Maddie Bug? You have said in the past during NCAA season, her setting tends to deteriorate at the end of sets. I can see what you're talking about, but they're doing really well.
I think that Fairbanks has a higher ceiling than Maddie Bug's. I think if Fairbanks and Bug are both playing at their best, I'm taking Fairbanks. I also think that Fairbanks runs the middle better than Bug does, but Bug seems to have a really good connection with the left sides for Atlanta. So this is kind of a very nuanced question in terms of where are your point producers coming from and who do you need to be playing well in order to win? So if Adams is going to be your main point scorer, and she looks at the coach and goes, I want Bug in, I hit her ball better, it's tough, right? And then it doesn't really matter for Fairbanks what's going on or how she's setting, because your top point scorer is grooving off bug. And I'm not saying that's happened, but there's a little bit of nuance here in terms of who players like and how you're scoring your points. And I think especially with the injury that they have to Grubbs. So I think all things equal, you want Fairbanks playing, but Bug has solidified herself with the left sides, in my opinion.
Our second question is, with the American leagues taking potential 2028 contenders from playing overseas, what is the probability of a random joining the rosters out of left field? And by random, this person was referring to Kim Hill, who didn't have a prolific NCAA career. She played at Pepperdine. She was kind of under the radar, but then emerged and became a star for USA and had an outstanding pro career. So do we think that there's going to be someone like that that's under the radar who might make big moves?
I think it's always possible. We're at the beginning of a quad. We have many years until the 2028 Olympics. You know, you could find some super athletic kid who's unpolished, who just goes to a program and experiences some success, and 2 years out from the Olympics gets a shot with the national team because, you know, she touches 11 feet and, you know, away you go. Am I banking on that if I'm in the USA gym? No. But is it out of the realm of possibility? No. And I think with the new coaching staff, they're probably on the hunt for athletes. They're defining what they want their team to look like. And we may see some players that we're not considering now. I think that's definitely a possibility.
And you get players who maybe fly under the radar in NCAA, but like sign contracts overseas and very quietly make their way up through the leagues. And like even watching Champions League, like I've never heard of some of these, like, there's a girl who went to UC Santa Barbara who's playing for Scandici, and I was like, whoa, I've never heard of her before. Do I think that she'll be on the national team? No, but I'm just saying there's some players that kind of fly under the radar and are getting better and are competing at a really high level that we don't even know about.
Well, and I think the other thing too is, you know, maybe you didn't have the best club coach. Maybe you went to a school for academic purposes and then you go overseas and you find an international coach who just can explain the game to you or trains you in a way that really gels with you, and all of a sudden you have this prolific increase in your skill. Like, that definitely happens as well. So always a possibility.
Our third question is, I was wondering if you thought Elena Scott has a chance to play for Team USA. I know you were impressed with her at Louisville and she's playing really well for Indy. I feel like it's so hard because I feel like USA is, or like national team programs can sometimes be political. And I think I love Elena Scott. I think she's so good. I think because Lexi Rodriguez has endeared herself to the public and to the volleyball community as a whole, I feel like she is just on people's radar because of that. I'm not saying it's fair, but I think that could kind of play a role, maybe.
I think she will be like one of the first left off the roster. I think she'll get a shot to be in the gym. I think they will look at her. I think she has to do a lot to prove herself in terms of playing at that level with the speed and the angles that the ball come at. There's no reference point for her for playing against those top international players. And if she wanted to do that, she would need to go find a contract overseas, in my opinion.
Yeah, I want Rodriguez to go overseas because I feel like, not that they're limiting themselves, but I feel like they could get so much better being exposed to the international style of play as opposed to staying domestically. I want to say that, yes, she would have a chance. I think she's good enough, but I also think that the jump from the level she's currently playing at to the Olympic level is large. Our fourth question is, how do you project Andrew Rowan's career? Do you think he can be the answer for USA after Micah Christensen?
Oh,
I love Andrew Rowan.
This is a great question. So here are my initial thoughts. Andrew Rowan is a cerebral setter. you can tell that he's thinking about how to execute his offense, how to move the defense around, where are they lined up, what are they trying to do against me. All of the mental components of being a great international setter, I think he has the framework to develop those skills. He needs to develop the other aspects of his game. He needs to put on a little bit of weight, in my opinion. You know, probably needs a little bit of a better serve. And, you know, blocking wise, he's not a small setter. The setting component, I think, is there. It's the rest of the game which will need to come into play for him to take that spot. But I think, I mean, I've seen Karch in the gym watching UCLA several times this year, and I'm sure he's got his eyes on him. So I think it's definitely a possibility. It's also, it will be interesting to see, you know, Tredd is 6'11", you know, coming in a little bit younger. You always want size, but is his offense quite as good, you know? And so there will be, he'll be in the mix, I think, for sure. And the last question we have for listeners' questions is, Sarah, how important was the Brazilian League for your development as a player? And do you think that the Superliga, which is the name of the Brazilian League, is viable for young athletes to develop before going to Italy or Turkey?
I want to say that the two leagues I played in that probably helped my development the most were the Italian League and the Brazilian League. At the time that I played in Brazil, all of the Brazilian national team women were playing domestically. You weren't seeing them leave. So the league was very, very strong at that time. And Brazil had just come off of winning the gold medal at the Olympics. So I was exposed to an incredibly high level of play every single day in practice and in matches. And then having Bernardinho coach, like, I learned a lot. I think everywhere I played kind of helped my development, but playing in Brazil was great. I think I got a lot better playing there.
A follow-up piece to that question was, do you think that it was the league that made you better or the coach specifically? Like, what would be the benefit versus coaching?
I mean, the Brazilian training style is definitely different. It's very high volume, high rep, without a lot of like talking in between. So you're kind of learning on the fly and you're figuring it out like by trial and error in the moment, which I thought was very interesting because my whole career as an athlete, I was like told, do this, try this. And so it was very interesting for that self-learning and self-teaching model. With economic situations, et cetera, you've seen a lot of the top Brazilian athletes move overseas for bigger contracts and stuff. So I think now the Brazilian league is still good and it's still strong. There's still a core group of athletes there that make the level high. So yeah, I definitely think it's a great place for young athletes to learn, be exposed to that style of training, that level of competition. Will the athletes who are capable and have that potential necessarily make the same amount of money they would make in Italy or Turkey? Not today, but I definitely would recommend to anybody to go play there because I think it's outstanding.
All right, looking forward to this week. There is a lot going on in the volleyball world, so there will not be any lack of matches to watch. We'll highlight a few here. The Love head-to-head this week is on Thursday at 8 o'clock p.m. Eastern. The bottom two teams will be battling it out to stay out of last place. So Omaha versus Madison. We've given our opinions on that one. That'll be on Love Live or DAZN. And then the weekend with Love is in Houston on Friday and Saturday. The Friday match between Houston and Atlanta, which will be again, will be on ESPN Plus.
We played last week. Let's watch them again.
And that match was the reverse sweep, so it'll be interesting to see what happens with that one. I would circle that one on your calendar and give that a watch. And the rest of the matches on Saturday will be on Love Live or the Women's Sport Network. Champions League on the women's side, quarterfinals are going to wrap up this week, so definitely watch those. You can see those on Wednesday and Thursday on Eurovolley.tv. And Men's Champions League, the quarterfinals first rounds are also starting this week as well. Those matches will be on Tuesday and Wednesday, also on Eurovolley.tv. In NCAA men's action, the Outrigger Invitational is happening this week in Hawaii. Ball State, Penn State, USC will be heading to the island for matches Thursday through Saturday. Stanford and Pepperdine have back-to-backs this week on Friday and Saturday at 9 p.m. Eastern. Those matches will be on Big Ten Plus. And then Saturday at 6 p.m. Eastern, Lewis and McKendree will face off also on ESPN Plus. That will be another interesting matchup given the rankings of those two teams. All right, if we look at PVF, Thursday at 7 p.m. Eastern, Omaha plays Indy. Go Indy, my choice. Omaha then also plays Orlando on Saturday at 7 p.m. Eastern, and we'll see whose prediction comes right in that one. And we also have the rest of the PVF matches on the YouTube channel, although in the last couple weeks they've also been on Roku as well. So
those two that you mentioned in particular said they're on YouTube, so we'll
see. Yeah, just keep an eye out on the website. They've been moving some of their channels around in case you're looking for them.
That concludes this week's episode of Volley Talk. There's always something shaking in the volleyball world, and we hope you enjoyed this little fix. Be sure to follow the show so you don't miss any updates, and we'd be so grateful if you'd leave us a 5-star review. You can also find us on Instagram at volleytalk_podcast. If you have a topic that you want us to discuss, be sure to let us know by reaching out to us on Instagram or at info@sarahpavin.com. Thanks so much for joining us, and we'll be back next week.